Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And 2 hours with Jimmy Akin is a wonderful way to spend an afternoon. All the questions this hour, just as they did last hour, coming to us via the internets, and all of the answers coming to us, as they did last hour, via the mind of Jimmy Akin. And I referred to it as the mysterious mind of Jimmy Akin. I was making not a literary reference, and
an allusion,
yes, to Jimmy Akin's mysterious world.
You're saying you're an illusionist.
I am a grand illusionist.
With an A.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How's things going over at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World? Is it still mysterious?
Oh, yeah. We've shed a little bit of light on our world, but it's still very mysterious.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the
Dyatlov Pass. Yeah. So for people who may not be aware, this is another podcast that I'm on, and it's produced by StarQuest. So you can just Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's available in different formats. You can even watch it on YouTube if you want. This month, let's see, we just had weight loss, mm-hmm. the mystery of weight loss. Why is it so hard to lose weight? Why does it keep coming back?
Yeah.
So just in time for everybody's New Year's resolutions.
Right.
Did a one on that mystery.
Right.
And that was kind of our science mystery for the month. I do different mysteries, like some of them are related to science, some of them are related to religion, some of them are related to history, some of them are related to space, you know, whatever. And so This month we had weight loss as our science mystery. And this Friday we're having Bob Lazar and Area 51 as our space mystery for UFOs. Then we're going to have astrology as our paranormal mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have Dyatlov Pass mm-hmm. as our historical mystery. Mm-hmm. It was a very mysterious incident that occurred in Siberia back in 1959.
1959, Dyatlov Pass. I'm going to find out. I will find out.
Have you looked it up? Do you know what it
involves?
No,
I keep forgetting. Every time I'm out of your presence, I forget to go look it up. So I'm going to if I don't, I'll just have to listen to it and be shocked. You should get like inside FBI information and stuff for your show.
I do.
What?
I'm not kidding.
I know.
Oh, okay. For the upcoming Bob Lazar episode, I called the FBI and talked to them to check out some of his claims.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Looking forward to that one.
Yeah.
Jimmy, the sleuth, and I know you were a professional sleuth at one point.
I was. Yeah. I've arrested people and all that stuff.
You have?
Oh, yeah. I've wrestled into the ground before arresting them.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they know you were coming?
Like, they were struggling to get away.
It wasn't from the back. Like you just snuck up on some stranger and wrestled them to the ground.
I and my partner have and I had different partners over, depending on who I was assigned to a given day. But my partner and I would have to, you know, tag team to take down a perpetrator and so forth.
Yeah. Assistant producer Marie is about to give me one of my favorite things. I just want to say thanks.
Oh, really?
Thanks for getting this for me, Assistant producer Marie. You're my best friend now. You're my best friend. What is it?
What is it?
I don't want to say on the air, but
I think it's a Diet Coke.
What? Yes, and she has moral obligations to giving me Diet Coke too, and she overcame them because she knew I was not.
Moral objections.
Yeah, she overcame the moral objections.
Okay.
To get me the Diet Coke. She doesn't believe that it's good for me, which I am almost certain she's correct about. But there's different definitions of the word good. All right. All the questions this hour come from the internet.
Mm-hmm. Came in through the tubes.
They came in through the pneumatic internet tubes that lead right into our building. We can get information off the internet directly into this building. And so Don asks this, Jimmy. The Catechism, section 2241 and 2242 puts legal duties and requirements of immigrants entering the country. Why don't we hear about those duties instead of, I guess, only hearing about what we have to, quote, give them?
Well, anytime that someone asks a question, why don't we hear more about X?
Mm-hmm.
I'm tempted to respond, you'll have to ask the people who are talking about this subject,
right?
Because I really can't speak for them.
I call CNN. They talk about this.
Yeah. Well, I suspect that this person, since Don refers to the catechism,
oh, yeah.
I suspect he means, why don't we hear more about it in church?
Ah.
And so properly speaking, you would want to ask churchmen. about this. You know, you don't ask priests and bishops and things like that. Why don't they talk about this more? And it's a legitimate question. And asking them this question, in fact, could prompt them to talk about this more.
Yeah. Okay.
Having said that, even though I can't answer for them, I can speculate a little bit about why we don't hear more about this from various churchmen. One reason is that, direction comes from the top. And the popes, even though they do talk about the duties that immigrants have in the catechism, they tend to talk more in favor of immigration.
Yeah.
And this is not just Pope Francis, although it certainly has been him, but it's been other recent popes too. I think one, and this is speculation on my part, I think one of the reasons they do that is because they're kind of positioning themselves as a humanitarian counterweight. Mm-hmm. The natural inclination of any nation state is to defend itself and of citizens to defend themselves and their jobs and things like that from competition. Just like any business, you know, doesn't want competition from others invading its territory. In the same way, there's a natural tendency on the part of people in given nations to protect their own and exclude people from other areas in one or another degree. And that generally means discouraging immigration. But there are big problems in the world. And a lot of people are in areas that are really suffering. And there are these humanitarian situations that need to be addressed. And so one way of addressing them is by allowing migrants to flee them and to get to a better environment. And since popes are called to call people beyond their comfort zone, I think popes tend to view themselves as a kind of humanitarian counterweight to natural human tendency. So whereas the natural human tendency would be to say, hey, it's not my problem. These people are from this other country. I need to look out for my own. Charity starts at home. I need to, you know, protect my own country and not deal with these problems coming in from elsewhere. That's the natural human tendency. And so popes tend to view themselves as having a responsibility to try to summon people to do more than that, to love the stranger and the foreigner and the widow and so forth. And so so you tend to get that from popes. You also tend to get that from bishops. And here in this country, I think one of the reasons that you get that from bishops is because we have a lot of immigrants in this country. In particular, we have a lot of immigrants in this country who come from a Catholic background.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that poses a unique pastoral situation here because not only do we have humanitarian concerns on the table, we also have pastoral concerns on the table. When these people are here, if the bishops took an alienating stance towards them, it would drive them away from the church.
Right.
They could either go to other churches that aren't Catholic and deprive themselves of the spiritual benefits of being Catholic, or they could give up religion altogether.
Yeah.
And so those are things that the bishops do not want to have happen. And so in particular, because we have a lot of immigrants in this country with a Catholic background, I think that tends to result in the U.S. bishops trying to relate to them in a favorable way rather than an alienating way. And so I think that also plays a role in why we hear more talk of being welcoming towards immigrants rather than stressing the responsibilities of immigrants that are mentioned in the catechism.
All right, Don, I hope that that was satisfying to you. Thank you so much for that question. It is an internet open forum today. All the questions coming to us from the internet for Jimmy Akin. And we go now to, clicked the wrong button. Clark, Jimmy. I don't know if this is
Clark.
Clark talks. Clark got really excited there for a minute. Jimmy, what would you say about the last couple verses of Revelation's 11?
Revelation?
I know. Did you hear what I did?
Yeah. You pluralized it.
Yeah. Revelation 11 and the first couple verses of 12, as it relates to the old Ark of the Covenant and Mary, the new Ark. Plus, would this answer the question so many have about what happened to the ark? To me, it seems to say it is in heaven.
Okay, so let's take a look at the text. This is the end of Revelation 11. We have the blowing of the seventh trumpet. John has been seeing a series of things happening in heaven that are patterned in groups of seven. The first series of seven is he sees a scroll that is sealed with seven seals, and Jesus opens each one of the seven seals. As a result of that, he then sees a series of seven angels that are given trumpets to blow, and they've been blowing the trumpets, and various things have been happening. And then the seventh angel blows his trumpets, and they're, according to verse 15, there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever," which is awesomely set to music by Handel.
I know.
And Handel's Messiah. It's
nice
just
job.
This is the Hallelujah chorus. I love this part. In any event, the 24 elders in heaven who then sit on their thrones fall on their faces and worship God. And they say various things. And then in verse 19, "Then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the Ark of the Covenant was seen within his temple. And there were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. And a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed in the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child, and she cried out in her pangs of birth, in anguish for delivery. And another portent appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems upon his head. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven, and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, that he might devour her child when she brought it forth. She brought forth a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to be caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness," and we'll leave off reading it at that point. It does go on from there. We've turned the corner there into chapter 12, and because I didn't want to create an artificial division in the mind between 11 and 12, because these chapter divisions were added centuries later.
Okay.
I just continued reading from the end of chapter 11. So the argument people make is that in chapter 11, the last thing we see is God's temple opened and the ark is seen in heaven. And then there are these flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, an earthquake, heavy hail. And then he sees this portent of a woman who gives birth to Jesus. Well, who gives birth to Jesus literally? It's
Mary.
The Virgin Mary.
Yep.
So it's a logical interpretation to say that this is the Virgin Mary that we're seeing here, at least in part, although we know that symbols in Revelation can also signify other things, multiple things. So, but at least part of this would seem to signify Mary. It's natural to think of her in this context. And this woman is mentioned right after the ark is mentioned as being seen in heaven. So, well, the ark contained the manna of that God had used to feed Israel during the Exodus. And the manna is then a symbol of Jesus, the other bread from heaven that we read about in the Gospels, in John's Gospel in particular. And so Mary, when she was pregnant with Jesus, contained Jesus. And so it's been natural for people to see Mary as a figure of, or as see the Ark of the Covenant as a figure in the Old Testament pointing forwards to Mary, because like the Ark, Mary contained the true bread from heaven. And since we have the symbol of the ark, or the image of the ark here juxtaposed with the image of a woman in heaven who seems to represent Mary, the ark is in the temple of heaven, the woman is depicted as being in heaven, it seems to many people that John here may be deliberately, consciously connecting the two, so that the ark is then a symbol of the Virgin Mary, not just in a way you could kind of deduce, but in a way, in the way it's actually pictured here in Revelation. Well, that's possible. Unfortunately, it's also a somewhat unclear passage in that it's hard to know where to go beyond that point. You can certainly say, okay, well, these two symbols are plausibly connected with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But then what inferences do you draw beyond that? You might be tempted to say, well, this is a sign that Mary has been assumed into heaven since the ark is depicted as being in the temple in heaven. And that's possible. Revelation could have been written after the Assumption of Mary, but it's a little difficult to say that with confidence because we then seem to back up in time to the birth of Jesus, and then the woman gets taken to a place of refuge in the desert to flee the dragon for a period of time, and there she seems to transition into functioning more as a symbol of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to say. The symbolism here is very rich and very deep, and that makes it somewhat difficult to interpret, like a lot of the book of Revelation. So it is plausible to see these as being connected, Mary and the Ark of the Covenant, but it's hard to draw firm conclusions when we go beyond that precisely because of the richness of the symbolism in Revelation. In terms of the second question that Clark asked, could this answer where is the Ark of the Covenant today? Could the Ark, like Mary, have been literally assumed into heaven? Well, it's possible. I can't rule that out. That's something that God in his omnipotence is certainly capable of doing. And so, you know, it's possible he could have assumed the ark. But it's also possible that this is just a symbol, that it may represent something else. It may represent that the ark is no longer on earth in the sense of don't expect to go find the ark somewhere,
mm-hmm.
It's been destroyed or something like that. The essence of what the ark was and what it represented is ultimately with God now. Don't think you're going to be finding it in some secret cave on earth. It may not have literally been assumed. It may have literally been destroyed. But in any event, it could be a sign that the age of the ark has passed.
Yeah.
And you're not to look for a physical ark anymore. Could also be the symbol we just mentioned, that maybe it's a sign the Virgin Mary's been assumed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's possible as well. But because John doesn't give us more detail, it's hard to know exactly what these symbols represent.
All right. Clark, thanks very, very much for that question. Right now, we got a free ebook available for you on our Facebook page. Go to Catholic Answers Facebook page now and download your free copy of Pro-Life Answers for a Brave New World, another part of Catholic Answers' effort during Pro-Life Month. Pro-Life Answers for a Brave New World, free ebook available now on the Catholic Answers Facebook page.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The reason people should listen is so they can get excited about the faith and then share that faith with others. Because that's what it's about. When we say, Jesus says, come follow me, but he also said, go and make disciples. We'll give you the tools needed for the new evangelization. Because that's the call to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Internet Open Forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest, Jimmy Akin. The next question comes from Salib via the internet. And Salib asks, insists first, Jimmy, the word holiday truly does not suit as a word for the Christmas feast day.
Okay, why not?
Liturgically, it's a double first-class feast or solemnity. I wish this does not offend you, but it has to be corrected. Holiday means vacation, not a festival. It's just a recent invention by humans, meaning I suppose the word holiday is a mm-hmm. recent invention. I wish we all remain with the origins, not the inventions. So you must have called Christmas a holiday.
No, maybe.
Or maybe said something about the Christmas holiday or something. Yeah.
Maybe, but Salib may just also be referring to the general practice of people who are English speakers referring to Christmas as a holiday. So there are several things to be said in this regard. The first one is it sounds like Salib may be more familiar with other forms of English than American English. And other forms of English, you'll notice Salib says that holiday means vacation.
Oh, right.
Well, holiday does not mean vacation in American English. If you say something is a holiday, you mean it's a special day of celebration. Mm-hmm. You don't mean a vacation. Holiday does mean vacation in British English.
Yeah, which most of the world more closely approximates.
Right. So in England or in Australia or in India or places like that where English is spoken, saying I'm going on holiday means I'm going on vacation.
Yes.
And if that's the resonance that you have for the word holiday, then I understand the sentiment that we don't want to just describe Christmas as a vacation. That sounds wrong. It's more than that. And so I certainly understand that sentiment. However, earlier in English, before holiday in British English came to mean a vacation, it meant a holy day. And a little bit, that's where it comes from. That's its word parts, holy day, holiday. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes from. And it's lost a little bit of that sense in English to where in American English, some holidays are holy, like Christmas and Easter.
Yeah.
But other holidays, like President's Day or whatever, are not holy days. And mm-hmm. so in English, it's come to mean, in American English, it's come to mean a day of special celebration that may be holy, but also might be a secular day of celebration that's not particularly holy. And so in American English, I would say it is appropriate to describe Christmas as a holiday because it is a day of special celebration and it happens to be one of the holy ones. So I would say in American English, it's perfectly fine to describe it this way. But I understand the impulse with British English to kind of resist that description a little bit, especially if you're familiar with the vacation usage. Having said that, the Holy See does not have a position on this. This is all intramural stuff involving English and different varieties of English. Mm-hmm. If you asked the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments, is Christmas a holy day, regardless of its specific rank on the calendar, they would say, yes, Christmas is a holy day.
Yeah.
And if you then said, okay, could you validly describe it as a holiday? Well, they would probably say it depends on which meaning you're using, but there would be legitimate English usages for holy day, mm-hmm. holiday, that could apply to Christmas.
Salib, thank you very, very much for that question. Now we go, Shan has a question. I have a strange question, she says. When Jesus was born, Joseph protected him and they fled to Egypt. Why then, when Jesus was 12, did he respond to his worried parents that they should know he was about his father's business? He was only 12. He went from a babe who needed protection to wondering why his parents were concerned at the ripe old age of 12 and an attitude of, he can take it from here. I hope I'm making sense. Thanks in advance. So why all the need for protection when he was a little baby?
Babies need to be protected more than 12-year-olds. As we get older, we become capable of doing more for ourselves and we need to be given the room and the space to do that. And so parents progressively need to protect their children less and let the children start standing on their own, 2 feet, both literally and figuratively, because their goal is not, as parents, is not to forever protect a child from the world, but to raise a functional adult. And that means progressively exposing the child to more and more responsibility and consequently to more and more potential danger. And apparently, by the time Jesus was 12, Mary and Joseph did not expect him to be in their presence at all times. And they expected him to be able to make certain decisions responsibly. And so they had traveled down in a group from Nazareth, and they had they presumably let him go play with other children. They didn't have to. They weren't, I don't know what the term is, not helicopter parents, but big brother parents. They weren't constantly insisting that he be with them.
Yeah.
And even, I know that's it's common actually these days for parents to be regarded as in some circles as needing to have their children with them at all times or under the authority of a babysitter or something. They can't be left alone. But that's a recent attitude. Even in my when I was growing up, it was expected. You're going to go outside. You're going to play with other kids. You're not going to be you're going to walk to school. You're not going to be protected by your parents at all moments. And the same thing was expected in Jesus' day. And so they assumed Jesus was still with the group. They assumed that he was making the responsible choice, in their view, to still be with the group. But he had a higher purpose they weren't aware of.
Shan, thanks very, very much for that question. We'll take a quick break and more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. We're here for you.
Author Mark McNeil spent years in the Oneness Pentecostal movement, praying in its lively services, zealously spreading its unconventional teachings, and rejecting mainstream Christianity as misguided. Then he left it all behind. All in the Name is the story of a man who believed he was among an elite group of believers who followed the true faith when so many others had strayed. But an inquisitive mind, careful study, and the action of the Holy Spirit finally led Mark out of Oneness Pentecostalism and into the Catholic Church. This is an inspiring conversion story you won't want to miss. It's a faith strengthener for Catholics and an intriguing challenge to those who deny the doctrine of the Trinity. Order your copy of All in the Name today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it is outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception, using scripture, papal and magisterial teaching, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent put forward a compelling case for Catholic teaching with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging onto the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, it's Deacon Harold Burke Zippers. Get your morning cup of coffee for your soul when I join Gloria Purvis and the Morning Glory team starting Monday, January 14th. Now let's return to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. I am Cy Kellett, your host and reader of questions today. This question comes to us from Karen, Jimmy. She says, this has to do with the possible change to the Our Father. With regards to God leading us into temptation, doesn't that also imply he is leading us to a trial for our own sanctification? Jesus was tempted 40 days fasting. Oh, after the 40 days of fasting, ultimately towards Satan tempting him to renounce God, which, of course, he did not do, I guess. So she's saying we could be led into temptation, and that wouldn't necessarily mean something bad.
Right. So we should probably set some context for this. Karen refers to a possible change to the Our Father. That's something that has kind of been reported in the news media, but it's kind of overblown. Here in America, there is no foreseen possibility of this changing anytime in the near future.
It does make good media, though.
Yeah, it's clickbait. What has happened is in France. Now, the Lord's Prayer gets translated different ways in different languages, and in some languages, like English, the last petition about "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil," those last two petitions get translated fairly literally from Greek. There's actually a debate because the last petition, deliver us from evil, That can be understood two ways in Greek. The way Greek grammar works, that could either mean deliver us from evil, the way it's commonly translated in English. It could also mean deliver us from the evil one.
Oh,
meaning
okay.
the devil.
All right.
And so there's an ambiguity there, but the one that tends to get translated differently and non-literally in a bunch of languages is the previous petition, lead us not into temptation, because it sounds like God could lead us into temptation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the book of James, for example, says he doesn't. The James says God is neither tempted nor does he tempt anybody.
Yep.
And so so to shield the listener from the potential misunderstanding that God might literally tempt people into sin, some languages this petition gets translated non-literally as things like don't let us fall into temptation,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the way it is in Spanish. Well, recently in France, about a year ago in France, they decided to switch the way they translated it from the more literal to the less literal in hopes of helping people avoid confusion on this part. And more recently, the Italian bishops, who had been doing a study on this for like 18 years or something, back during the reign of John Paul II, they'd been studying this.
I'd like to get that job. That's a very steady gig. If they're going to – I'll study it for 18 years for you.
Yeah. Well, I think it'd be pretty boring with one question for 18 years.
As long as the checks don't bounce, Jimmy.
they decided to switch it in Italy as well. And
okay.
so in both occasions, Pope, or at least in the first occasion, Pope Francis was asked about it, and he made supportive comments of the French bishops doing this. He didn't say, oh, they mustn't.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, you know, things that were positive about it, which isn't surprising because as a Spanish speaker, he's been used to the Spanish version for ages.
Yeah.
Well, the English speaking press then ran with this as like Pope changes Lord's Prayer when the Pope didn't change it at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was the French bishops and later the Italian bishops. And the mere fact that he signals he doesn't have a problem with this doesn't mean that the American bishops are about to propose the same thing. I think it very unlikely that the American bishops would do anything like that anytime soon, precisely because it would upset a lot of people and it would lead to charges that they are falsifying the Word of God. It would harm ecumenical relations. It would cause all kinds of problems, justly or unjustly. There would be all kinds of problems. And so I don't foresee this happening in America at any time in the near future. But that leaves us with the actual question. So that's the context. That leaves us with the question that Karen asks. Could you conceive of being led into temptation as being led into an occasion of sanctification? And the answer is yes. By resisting temptation, we grow in sanctification. And so you could say, and in every evil, God brings some good out of it. And so one could conceptualize God leading us into temptation as leading us into an occasion of sanctification. Sure, that's fine. One can conceive of it that way. The question is that how Jesus is conceiving of it here?
Yeah.
And the answer to that seems to be no, because Jesus or encourages us to pray, don't lead us into temptation.
Yeah.
And so so here, the way Jesus is conceptualizing it on this occasion, temptation is something to be avoided. And so even though you could think of it the way that Karen is proposing, that's a legitimate way to think of it, it doesn't seem to be the way that Jesus is thinking of it here.
Right.
And therefore, it doesn't provide an argument for translating it more literally rather than less literally. By the way, one other thing about literalness in the Lord's Prayer. Sometimes people have the idea we need to be as literal as possible in our translation of things. But that's not true. The function of translation is to communicate ideas clearly. And sometimes that means going less literal. And I can even prove that God doesn't have a problem with that.
All right.
By looking at the Lord's Prayer itself, because it comes to us in two different versions, one in Matthew and one in Luke. And in the version in Matthew, Jesus teaches us to pray. This is translating literally from the Greek. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Mm-hmm. Now, in English, we translate that non-literally as Catholics. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So right there, that's a non-literal translation of the Lord's Prayer. But what's interesting is when you take what Matthew says in Greek, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, and compare it to Luke's version of the same petition, Luke doesn't say debts.
What does he say?
Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who are indebted to us. And so he takes the metaphor of debt that was used in Aramaic culture, and since he's writing for a more Gentile audience to ease them over that conceptual hump, he takes debts and replaces it non-literally with sins so that they get the idea that's the kind of indebtedness we're talking about here.
So
even there, in the inspired Word of God, you have a non-literal version of this prayer.
Again, it is Internet Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And the next question, Jimmy, comes from Christy, who asks, what do you say to a little girl who had just reached the, quote, age of reason? So usually that's conceptualized at about seven. I guess that's what she means. And this little girl has three times in the last week said that she wants to be a boy when she grows up. In the era of sex changes being normalized, it's scary to think who might overhear her, as it's most likely just a phase, and then other authorities decide she should be living a transgender lifestyle. So I see what this person's saying. By the way, this is a little girl who literally loves to wear dresses and play with dolls, but at the moment she says she wants to grow up, become a boy, and marry a wife. So how do you deal with that? Which sounds like a perfectly normal little kid.
You have more experience with perfectly normal little kids than I do.
No, none of mine.
I've only been one, but I haven't had any of my own.
But
people do have, and especially young children who have fanciful ideas at times,
or they know what will push your buttons.
They know what will push your buttons. Yeah, there are all kinds of reasons a child might say that, and it might be just a passing fad, as indicated. In fact, Christy says it's probably that. Right. In terms of what risk is there of someone overhearing and having a problem with it? If you thought that was a serious risk, then you could either talk to the child and say, let's talk about that stuff when we're at home or something. Let's not talk about that in school. But then that might prompt exactly that behavior, because now you've created forbidden fruit.
Yeah.
You could take your kid out of public school or whatever. But, that's something you can't do easily or forever. You can't forever shield your child from contact with others, as we indicated. And it would be hard even frequently to do so just for the period that this phase lasts. I think, though, and I can't speak to every circumstance, but I think the odds of a little girl saying this as part of a phase, and then the phase wears off, and then the authorities want to swoop in and make this happen is very low. So I would say it's probably something you don't need to be that concerned about. So if she were to continue to say such things and it becomes clear this is not just a phase, well, then that's something to be more concerned about, but not because of the authorities swooping in, but because it's not a phase. She's got a more profoundly disordered understanding of these things. And so you need to talk to her directly about some of these at some point. But the fact that you mentioned she loves to play with dolls and things like that and do these typical, archetypical female girl activities, it is probably a passing phase or something like that. And in that case, I don't think the danger of the authorities swooping in and doing anything is high.
Christy, thank you very, very much for that question. It is Pro-Life Month here in America this month. January is Pro-Life Month, and Catholic Answers wants to get as many pro-life resources out as we can. So all of our pro-life stuff, of which there is a significant amount, including books, DVDs, MP3s, booklets, ebooks, it's all just $5 in the pro-life category at shop.catholic.com. During this pro-life month, go to shop.catholic.com and get all those pro-life resources, $5 each.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Atheists often justify their atheism by saying there's no scientific evidence for God. But this is problematic for two reasons. First, science can no more detect God than a metal detector can detect plastic cups. God, who is immaterial, is beyond the scope of scientific inquiry because science is restricted to detecting matter. This leads to a second critique. The argument confuses method with reality. Science's inability to detect God says nothing whether or not God exists. It's simply a manifestation of the limitations of its detecting powers. To say God doesn't exist because science can't detect him is to confuse the limitations of the method for knowing reality with what is real. So it really doesn't matter that science can't detect God, and therefore is not a justifiable reason to be an atheist. I'm Carlo Broussard with the Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business and so he's working by himself and he listens to Catholic radio. He's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Internet Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And Jenny asks the following via the internet. Says, I would love an explanation why each diocese sets the age to receive confirmation. Why do some parishes take it even further to require activities hours to attain the sacrament and other parishes within the same city do not? What gives with all of this?
Okay. So in the Latin Rite of the Church, confirmation is... for children is not celebrated typically at the same time as baptism. It's celebrated after the age of reason, and the Code of Canon Law doesn't specify a particular age where it's to be celebrated. And so it leaves that decision to bishops' conferences. And a number of years ago, the U.S. bishops tried to basically not set that not set an age. And the Holy See told them, well, you know, you need to have a policy on this. And so they came back and said, okay, our policy is that each diocese gets to decide for itself. And the Holy See said, okay. So that's why it's different in each diocese.
Uh-huh. That policy seems very close to no policy at all.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
Strikingly similar.
Yeah, strikingly similar. But then the as far as the requirements set in different parish programs, that's going to be up to the bishop. I can imagine bishops in different dioceses having different policies themselves on that. Some of them may have a policy that says, okay, everyone in the diocese needs to use this program with these set of requirements for confirmation. Other bishops may give individual pastors more flexibility in setting the confirmation programs in their parishes. So the ultimate explanation is the Vatican approved the overall age policy in the United States, and the bishop approves the policy in his diocese for how parishes are going to do it and what degree of flexibility they have.
All right, Jenny, thank you very, very much for that question. Karen asks, regarding Catholics who are promoting heresy,
okay,
how do we effectively deal with groups like Facebook groups when present a false Catholic view? She actually lists Catholics for Choice, mm-hmm. for example. Okay, so when trying to engage with them, it doesn't seem to have any real effect. Mm-hmm. Should we continue to engage so that others on the periphery will see orthodox answers, or just shake the dust off our feet and leave?
It's a judgment call. There's mm-hmm. no one right answer on this. In some situations, engagement up to a point has a role, but then there also comes a point where your time would be better spent doing something else. St. Paul tells Timothy at one point, you know, after you rebuke a man twice, have nothing to do with him, because he's obviously not listening to you. So you can go employ your efforts more profitably elsewhere. Now, if you're, say, engaging on Catholics for Choice church's Facebook page, and they're not banning you, and you're people seem to be listening to you, even if it's not the Catholics for Choice people, but other people, you know, who are overhearing this, you seem to be getting some positive response, then that would be a sign that this is an occasion to go ahead and keep engaging. On the other hand, if you get no response from anybody, well, there are probably other things that you can do, no positive response from anybody, then there are probably other things you could do that would be more productive.
All right, Karen, thank you very, very much for that question. Kathy, Jimmy, would like to hear any thoughts you have on defending religious freedom.
I think it's a good thing to defend religious freedom.
That is a thought.
Yeah.
That is remarkably close to no policy at all. No.
No. I don't know that I have any particular thoughts about it. I mean, it's something that needs to be done. It can be done in a variety of different ways. One way that it needs to be done is by contacting our government officials and letting them know that they need to respect religious liberty and they need to institute policies and laws defending religious liberty. There are situations in which one can support organizations that are devoted to this. There are, you know, organizations devoted to protecting people's religious rights. They litigate various court cases. They write amicus briefs for various courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. It needs to be dealt with on that front. Just raising awareness of violations of religious liberty, whether it's even, you know, even we mentioned Facebook a minute ago. You know, you can go on social media and talk about situations where people's religious liberty has been violated. You know, there was the famous cake shop incident a number of years ago where a Christian baker was, you know, being coerced into making a cake celebrating a homosexual wedding. And when and not everybody was aware of that. I remember there was an interview with a government lawmaker who was like told about this for the first time during an interview and was like, oh, that never happens. It's like, no, yes, it does. Uh-huh. And so there's a consciousness raising that needs to happen about the dangers of religious liberty. And that's something we can all participate in.
All right, Kathy, thank you very, very much. Kevin asks, Jimmy, after the second coming and the final resurrection, what bodies – oh, this is an interesting way he phrases this. Okay. What bodies will former humans have – and what will angels have? Will I be able to play pickup basketball with St. Michael?
Well, you could play pickup basketball with St. Michael if St. Michael cooperates right now. Angels have the ability.
You're not going to win, though.
Well, it depends on how many points he spots you.
Yeah, right.
The angels have the ability to affect things here in the world. Even though they're non-physical beings, they can have physical effects, and we see that in Scripture. And so if St. Michael had nothing better to do, he right now could telekinetically move a basketball and play pickup ball with you. So if you can do that now, then you could definitely do that in the next life.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what bodies will we have, well, we don't know a whole lot about them. We know there will be bodies. We also know they're going to be significantly upgraded. We have reason to think that we're going to be able to do things similar to what Jesus could do, like walk through walls and stuff like that. So they're going to be supernaturalized. But we don't know a whole lot. St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 discusses this question because he's talking about the resurrection. He says, now, some of you are going to ask, well, what kind of body do we have? And he's a little dismissive of that. It's like, we can't really say, but he compares it, the difference between our present body and our resurrection body, to the difference between a seed that's kind of humble and unimpressive and the glorious plant that grows from the seed. And so we have an indication our bodies are going to be way better. They're not going to have the kind of limitations and flaws that our present ones do. But exactly what that means is unclear. In terms of angels, we have no reason to think that angels are going to have bodies. Now, they can assume human appearance and maybe human form, but they don't natively have bodies the way we do because by nature, they're creatures of intellect, whereas we're both spiritual and physical by nature, which is why we're going to be resurrected, because we wouldn't be complete without both halves of our nature. Angels, though, just have a spiritual nature, and so they don't natively have bodies, although they may transiently assume them or have the appearance of bodies. But even without bodies, they can affect things in the world. So they have telekinesis, and you could play basketball with them right now if they wanted.
Kevin, thanks for the question. It struck me that Kevin might have mentioned something that doesn't exist here.
What's that?
What bodies will former humans have? Is there such a thing as a former human?
Well, if you ask a transhumanist, yeah.
Yeah. I used to be a human. Now I'm a computer.
I assume that what he means by that is, and you're right, they're properly speaking, once a human, always a human, except Aquinas would say that if you have died and you're without your body, you're not a complete person.
Oh, right.
And
right.
So you're not a complete man or woman, or you're not a complete human.
Yeah.
And so you could think of people who have died and don't have their bodies presently as former humans who then regain their body and become human again.
Oh, that's interesting. Right, right. Because we are, because we're a body-soul composite,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Then that's what a human person is,
right.
A body-soul composite.
Yeah.
So if you're not a body-soul composite, even for a little while.
Yeah, you still have consciousness, but you're not a full human being without that body.
You are happy, however, though. I just want to clarify that.
Well, I am, personally.
No, I mean, I don't mean now. I mean, if you are...
if you're among the blessed.
If you're among the blessed, yeah. You're all right. There's nothing wrong with you. Ryan asks this. This seems like a particularly Jimmy Akin type question. Mm-hmm. What is philosophy? Common misconceptions about it. Why are many atheists, do they prefer science to philosophy?
Okay, so there's a number of questions there. Philosophy, the roots of the word mean the love of wisdom. And so that's kind of originally how philosophy was conceived, as an investigation into the subject of wisdom. A philosopher was a person who loved wisdom and thought about various issues in a profound way and thus acquired wisdom. And that's the kind of fundamental enterprise of philosophy. Now, over the course of time, various disciplines have split off from philosophy. All of what we now call science used to be called natural philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
It was the study of the basic principles of nature. And so originally that was part of philosophy. And with time, different things have drifted away. And so what's left is, in contemporary philosophy, is the study of certain very basic questions. Questions that Aristotle might have considered as part of his philosophy, like, what's the nature of earthquakes?
Yeah.
Well, okay, that's now part of geology.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other very basic questions like, what's the nature of reality?
Yeah.
That still belongs to philosophy. And so philosophy deals with basic questions about the world and about man and about knowledge and about values and so forth. So these days, philosophy investigates very fundamental questions in a range of different areas. Now, in terms of atheists, you will find some atheists who say things like, well, philosophy has been superseded at this point. Science has replaced it.
Right.
And Stephen Hawking, you know, made that argument in one of his later books. The problem is that's nonsense. He was very harshly criticized for that because science itself presupposes certain philosophical questions that cannot be scientifically demonstrated. And so he's by dissing philosophy, he was actually undercutting the basis of science, which presupposes certain philosophical viewpoints that you can't prove scientifically. And if you want to read more about that, just, you know, Google Stephen Hawking philosophy and you'll find some critiques of what he had to say.
All right. Thank you so much for that question. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much for a very fine hour.
My pleasure.
You can find out about Jimmy at jimmyakin.com, or you can find out about one of his several podcasts. Just search Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Tomorrow, we're going to help you get in spiritual shape. We're going to talk about spiritual fitness. And then we end the week with a kids Q&A. So, Tim Staples will be here to answer questions from the younger set. If you are a kid or if you've got a kid, dial before that second hour or during that second hour tomorrow.